This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Hoosier History. From local history journals and books from across the Hoosier State, you'll learn the stories of the people and events that have shaped our present. For the next 60 minutes, it's Hoosier History, right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Hoosier History, and I'm your reader, Pat, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from a variety of publications about Indiana history. And now I'll begin with We Do History, Indiana Historical Society, copyright 2025. Growing Old With You. This is from August 28, 2025. Lately, I have processed two collections in particular that featured couples who enjoyed long marriages. I always find it fascinating to see photos of people in different stages of their lives. In this case, it was interesting to see these couples when they were young and enamored with each other, and then when they were older, after many years of hard work and good fortune to stay together. And with wedding season in full swing, and presumably anniversary season, I thought I would share some of these Hoosier pairings of the past as inspiration. Jack Schwartz, 1900 to 1992, was born on a farm about 4 miles north of Bern, Indiana. When he was 19, he began working as a teacher at the Mennonite Parochial School. In 1924, he married a neighbor girl, Edna Habiger, 1906 to 1998. Edna was the fourth of eight children of Joel H. and Elizabeth Maslin Habiger. Jack and Edna had three children. Their oldest, Marie, also became a teacher and, as an adult, helped her mother Edna with her high school equivalency courses. At the age of 57, Edna completed the courses with a 90% average. Jack and Edna lived in Napanee, Indiana, and then later moved to Goshen, evidently with a lot of vacations to Florida in between. I also persist a collection of photo albums and scrapbooks from Jean Ranson Thomas, 1916 to 2002, and Charles J. Thomas, 1913 to 1989. Jean and Charles came to Indianapolis from Columbus, Ohio, after Charles got a job teaching industrial arts in public schools here. He later went to Butler and eventually taught at Shortridge High School. They were married in 1936. Charles was a veteran of World War II. I thought it was very sweet how Jean stayed close to him while he was receiving his training in Aberdeen, Maryland. She got a job selling cigars at the local exchange branch and lived at the service club. Once Charles deployed to Europe, she kept a very nice scrapbook of everywhere he went and everything he sent her. In 1986, the couple celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. Judging from the photo below, they were just as bonkers for each other as ever. All this enduring moonshininess reminds me of the 1998 Adam Sandler movie, The Wedding Singer, in which he sings to Drew Barrymore, "I want to make you smile whenever you're sad, carry you around when your arthritis is bad. All I want to do is grow old with you. I'll get your medicine when your tummy aches, build you a fire if the furnace breaks. Oh, it could be so nice growing old with you." You can learn more about Jack and Edna in the Eichenberger, Schwartz, and Habiger family collection, also known as M1540. The Jean and Charles Thomas collection, which includes that great World War II scrapbook, is P0909. That's the end of the article. Matt Holtzcomb, the author, is an archivist at the Indiana Historical Society. He's a circus history enthusiast, dog person, puppeteer, casual cyclist, and karaoke nut. The next article is Get Revved Up. August is National Motorsports Month. The date on this is August 25th, 2025. It's so easy in Indiana, and specifically in Indianapolis, to focus on the Indy 500 or other events at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway when seeking out materials illustrating National Motorsports Month. However, except for the lovely illustration of that race shown above, I managed to track down a variety of other motorsports and events to highlight instead. Gold and Glory was a sweepstakes series created and run by the Colored Speedway Association starting in the 1920s. While the race in Indianapolis was usually held at the Indiana State Fairgrounds on the dirt track, there were occasions when it was held elsewhere. The race was held for a few years on July 4th, but also saw race dates in August and September throughout its history. Speedboat races on the White River were common enough that in September 1954, the National Outboard Association held their championships on that body of water in Indianapolis. According to newspaper reports, only one Hoosier, Todd Wolfram of Rome City, received top honors in their category. Other winners distributed across the seven races hailed from Texas, 3, Florida, 2, and Missouri, 1. The Indianapolis Raceway Park, technically located in the Clermont-Brownsburg area, opened in 1960. It has held many events related to the National Hot Rod Association. These drag race events hosted different types of cars fitting into various categories. I can't help but enjoy the funny car category as evidenced by the car in the above images bottom right. This particular Camaro was driven by Phil Smith in that division in 1984. Motorcycle racing has seen a variety of venues in Indiana. The above races were both held in Indianapolis at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. One race, shown at the top, was part of the Indiana State Fair's activities in 1952. The other, shown at the bottom, was an American Motorcycle Association Grand National Series race in 1976. Show riding the number 25 motorcycle is Jay Springsteen, who won the overall series in 1976, 1977, and 1978 after being awarded the Rookie of the Year by the AMA in 1975. While I am unable to show all the different types of motorsports racing that has taken place in Indiana over the years, I hope this group of examples helps you to have a little more motorsport pride for the Hoosier State. Keep an eye on the IHS blog site for more great content from the collections. This was written by Amy Vidra, the Director of Reference Services. As an avid reader, she reads as many books as possible annually. All books count. Audio, e, and print. The next article is August Celebration Days, Veeps and Eats, August 20th, 2025. In August, we observe many obscure days. Some of my favorites have to do with pets, especially dogs. But as I have tackled at least one of those previously, I decided to take a look at a couple of the other days included for the month. This led me to National Veep Day, celebrating the line of succession and the vice presidency, as well as National Chop Suey Day, highlighting the classic Americanized Chinese dish. Indiana claims 6 different men who have served as vice president of the United States. Although only 3 of them were born in the state, the other 3 had extensive connections to Indiana. The first Hoosier to serve as vice president was Schuyler Colfax. Colfax was born in New York, but moved to northern Indiana as a preteen. After a career as a newspaperman and politician, he was elected with President Ulysses Grant in 1868, but Colfax did not seek re-election to the vice presidency for Grant's second term. Born in Ohio, Thomas A. Hendricks moved to Indiana with his family during his first year of life. He served as an Indiana-based politician, serving at the state and federal levels prior to the presidential election in 1885. Unfortunately, Hendricks died just 8 months into the term. His place as Grover Cleveland's vice president was left vacant for the remainder of that president's first term. Cleveland lost the subsequent election but was re-elected in 1893. Charles Warren Fairbanks was born in Ohio, spending his youth and early adulthood through college there. After spending a couple of years working for the Associated Press while studying law, he passed the bar, got married, and moved to Indianapolis all around the same time. Fairbanks didn't enter the political arena until 1888 while working for Walter Q. Gresham's campaign. His first run for office for U.S. Senator in 1893 failed to achieve success. He was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1897 and then again in 1903, but opted to resign from the second term to take on the challenge as vice president under Theodore Roosevelt from 1905 to 1909. Fun fact, Fairbanks was the nephew of William Henry Smith, who was affiliated with the Associated Press and for whom the IHS Library is named. Thomas R. Marshall was the first Hoosier-born U.S. vice president, having started his life in North Manchester, Wabash County. Due to his mother's health struggles, his physician father moved the family around, seeking a better climate to aid his wife's physical health, spending time in Illinois, Kansas, Missouri, and perhaps elsewhere, before settling back in Indiana. Marshall served as governor of the state before his election to serve as Woodrow Wilson's vice president from 1913 to 1921. Several decades passed before a Hoosier once again saw the office of the vice presidency, J. Danforth Quayle, born in Huntington, Huntington County. Quayle served with President George H. W. Bush from 1989 to 1993. Before that, he held political positions at the federal level for his home state from 1977 to 1989 in the House of Representatives and then the Senate. The most recent Hoosier to serve as vice president was Columbus, Bartholomew County-born Mike Pence. Pence worked as an attorney before entering the political arena. After some failed campaigns, he was successfully elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, for which he served until 2011, after which he ran for and was elected governor of Indiana. Though initially planning to seek a second gubernatorial term, he stepped down from that election to run and win as Donald J. Trump's vice presidential nominee, serving during Trump's first of two non-consecutive terms from 2017 to 2021. August is more than the line of presidential succession, though. I happily present to you an additional day celebrated in the month of August, National Chop Suey Day. As noted in the National Day calendar entry, the origins of chop suey are less than clear, much like the origin of the nickname Hoosier. Some say it was a dish created to mimic Chinese cuisine, but set for Western palates. Others note that there may have been a dish in a region of China that had a similar name, which was made up primarily of scrap or leftover ingredients. Either way, I find my family's chop suey delicious, despite its very Americanized look. An image of our family's version can be found at the top of this post, courtesy of my sister, who made the dish this month and shared the image with me. Included above are some of the Oriental Shoyu Company's recipe options for chop suey, as printed in their 1946 cookbook. I hope you enjoyed learning a little more about Indiana's vice presidents, as well as the delicious options for chop suey. Don't forget to check out more great blog content on our blog site. This was written by Amy Vidra. Now we're reading Indiana Historical Society, Summer 2025, Traces of Indiana and Midwestern History. Copyright 2025, Indiana Historical Society Press. I Remember When. The Traveler by Georgia Giannikos Buchanan. They left their family, friends, and country with big dreams and meager possessions to chase their dream in America, the country they had heard was so rich its streets were paved with gold. The gold they found, however, came with the opportunity to turn dreams into reality. This is my story of one of the dreamers. It was a bone-chilling January afternoon in 1920. Snowflakes swirled down from the gray skies, meeting and sticking on the already slippery streets. Walking confidently with steady strides along South Illinois Street in downtown Indianapolis was a 17-year-old immigrant boy. While avoiding the snow piles with his footsteps, his eyes were focused directly ahead. His goal was within reach. Minutes before, he had alighted from a train at Union Station that had carried him from Chicago. He followed other departing passengers through the maze of corridors of the massive train hub and was pleased to find himself taking the few steps leading to the wintry outdoors. The oversized, bulky, long black coat hung over his slender body like a bag. His legs were protected with heavy wool pants. A long-sleeved gray shirt and two cardigan sweaters were layered over his chest. His lightweight shoes offered little protection from the cold, and the flaps from his cap covered his ears. His left hand held a large cardboard box secured with double leather belts. He had no gloves. His hand was stuffed in his coat pocket, clutching a crumbled piece of paper. His right hand held his papers and his Greek-English dictionary. The paper had the word State House scribbled on it. He had shown the message to an employee at Union Station and was told to walk north, then west, downtown to find his destination. The teenager's eyes eagerly followed the porter's pointed finger. It directed him to walk straight ahead and turn left within two streets. Downtown Indianapolis was a bustling urban center where automobiles were now competing with streetcars, bicycles, and a few mules and horses as means of transportation. Storefronts advertised cafes, cigar stores, and shoeshine parlors. There were boarding houses and large hotels beckoning customers with their large posters promoting their attractions. The words and messages meant nothing to the young traveler, as he knew only a handful of words in English. He spoke and understood only the language of his native country. The traveler made his way into the center of the bustling city. His strides were quick and not a challenge, as he was used to physical labor outdoors, growing up farming and chasing sheep through the hills of his native village. He was filled with anticipation with every step. The long ordeal that had brought him to the capital city was like a dream forever etched in his mind, and still he was grateful he had survived. It had been almost a month since his decision to leave his village outside Sparta. He was following his father and other young men from the Peloponnesus region of Greece to America. The Greeks, with their love of independence, had a history of mobility and traveling the sea. Centuries ago, they had fought the Ottoman Empire and later a war of independence. The late 1800s saw a surge of emigration of young Greek men yearning to escape poverty and civil war. With bleak futures, a new country spelled opportunity for work. They wanted to accumulate money they could send back to their village. They wanted life to be better for their families left behind. The young traveler saw his father leave 3 years before, and he had promised him he would stay behind to look after his mother, sisters, and others in the village. But beyond the rocky mountains, winding roads, olive trees, and poverty dotting the landscape, the promise of a better life beckoned. He would be turning 18 in a few months and had already planned to break the promise to his father and pack his meager belongings. He had his own dream of coming to America. His mother understood her restless son. His journey began. Blue skies, purple mountains, and farm life were left behind as mules carried him out of the village of Sparta and to the port of Patras. Embarkation steamships were docked. He bonded with other men who had come from other parts of southern Greece to buy passage for their ocean voyage. They had little resources. Steerage class on the ship became their home for the next 3 weeks. He traveled in the bowels of the ship where conditions were too hot and too cold, cramped and unsanitary. he slept in a bunk bed with an emigrant below him and another above. Days and nights stretched to eternity. Disease and sickness were constant companions. The traveler was not a good sailor and ate all the potatoes that were given to keep up his strength. He felt ill most of the time. There were many port stops along the way, including Italy and Spain, before the ship churned slowly across the Atlantic Ocean. He was grateful for lack of movement. It made him feel better. It would be 20 days before the ship entered New York Harbor. Ellis Island, the oasis from where they would be allowed entry into the United States, was still 3 days away. He and his fellow passengers were herded into ferry boats from the steamship. A ripple of excitement buoyed their spirits when they caught a glimpse of the Statue of Liberty. To many of the passengers, the elegant, gigantic lady with the outstretched arm holding the flaming torch reminded them of the Olympic torch of their native Greece. The door to America was open. He joined the long lines on Ellis Island that moved from the waiting rooms, kitchens, registry office, hospital rooms, and railway ticket offices. The baggage room was piled high with baskets, boxes, suitcases, and trunks. The basket given to him by his mother was searched, and all passengers were checked for head lice and signs of illness. Many were not allowed to register for entry into America because they were sick. The traveler became terrified he would be one of those turned away because he had caught a cold. He practiced stifling his cough as he moved through the lines for his medical check. To his relief, he was not pulled out. The registry room was clearance to America and was the last stop. He was relieved as his papers were stamped for entry. This was it. He was now officially an immigrant. The young traveler followed two immigrants from Athens to the railway's window. They each bought one-way tickets to Chicago. Fellow passengers from their vessel fanned out to all parts of the United States. The long train ride to the Midwest seemed endless, and he used the time to study the Greek-English dictionary he had bought in Patras. He tried memorizing English words, money exchange rates, and money orders. The pocketbook dictionary would be his companion for life. The basket with his meager belongings broke open beyond repair, and a railroad employee found him a large box to transfer his possessions into. He took off his belt and fastened it around the box. It was his only luggage. Chicago was a city with a huge influx of Greek immigrants and relatives of his traveling companions. They welcomed him for a few days. Those who had picked up the English language were helpful as he sought another rail ticket to his destination, Indianapolis. Within the day, his train had pulled into Union Station, located at Jackson Place. The Midwestern city was still feeling the glow from the late 1800s, which were tagged the golden years in which the arts flourished. The Roaring Twenties lay ahead. The city had celebrated its 100th birthday. The expansion of the railroads and the proximity of Union Station to the center of town made the Indiana capital an urban hub for travelers. Large hotels, restaurants, clothing stores, movie houses, and cafes beckoned for political rallies, meetings, lodgers, shoppers, and those seeking entertainment. The city had been laid out with a symmetrical blueprint, with the streets running north, south, east, and west, fanning out from the circular street in the center. Dominating Monument Circle was an ornamental and elaborate structure, the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, with amazing statuary and fountains. Its crowning glory was a statue of Miss Indiana dubbed Victory facing south. The monument had changed the center of the city from a previous park-like setting into a commercial beacon surrounded by office buildings, hotels, and shops. A few years earlier, it had been jam-packed with celebrants for a parade marking the end of the war. The Grand Monument, soaring 284 feet into the Indiana sky, was the first monument dedicated to the common soldier. German architect Bruno Schmitz was selected to oversee its construction. It was completed at the turn of the century, and many called it the city's exclamation point. Dominating an entire quadrant of the circle was the English Hotel and Opera House. Architecturally elaborate with turrets and spirals, it featured a huge balcony supported by massive columns. They formed a canopy over the entrance. There were storefronts on the ground level and a cafe wrapped around one corner. Automobiles angled parked in front. The Opera House featured not only operas, but stage plays and musicals. The hotel was the site of the city's first art exhibition by the Art Association, the forerunner of the Herren School of Art. On another quadrant, the newly built Circle Theater reigned as an elegant lady with her neoclassical features. Amazing craftsmanship had built it as a movie house with stage shows and later concerts. The white, ornate facade featured a huge circular clock on its roof. It was one of many great movie houses sprinkled throughout downtown. Dominating another corner on the circle was the Christ Church Cathedral, a striking Gothic structure designed by Irish architect William Tinsley. Next door stood the Columbia Club, a private club engaged in political life. Churches, movie houses, and hotels were joined by office buildings and shops. They replaced residents of Circle Street that had been known as Circle Park. A large boarding house remained. The young immigrant, with the wind continuing to lash across his exposed and chapped face, looked back only once after beginning his trek across the busy sidewalks. He did not notice the magnificent architectural gem from which he had departed. The gigantic Romanesque Revival structure was not only a railroad hub, but an architectural wonder. Built of red brick, it featured a waiting room with a cathedral-like skylight and stained glass windows. Walking along South Illinois Street, he passed the four-story Spencer Hotel and several movie houses featuring westerns and B-movies. Behind Union Station, Irish, Italian, and German immigrants had established neighborhoods. Italians ran fruit and vegetable markets, established Catholic parishes, and began making their way into the arts. The Irish district was known as Irish Hill, and many worked as laborers building railroads and canals, and they too established churches. The Germans began German-American newspapers, mutual aid societies, and their own amusement park, which featured baseball, dance pavilions, and tennis courts. It was known as German Park on South Meridian. It already had big players in the arts, and their architects designed many of the downtown churches and public buildings. Emmerich Manual High School on the south side was named for Charles Emmerich, who was its first principal. A young piano-playing student attended classes at Manual and went on to become the well-known Hoagy Carmichael. The south side was home to the freight houses for the railroads. The sleeping giant Eli Lilly and Company was producing pharmaceuticals, and the Slippery Noodle Inn was in business. As the young traveler approached the intersection on Illinois Street and the city's main street, Washington, running from east to west, he was met with a blanket of large hotels, office buildings housing dentists and doctors, elegant department stores, trunk shops, and a newspaper office. Pedestrians were crossing the snow-laden streets, dodging trolley cars and automobiles. He paused at the curb and took a deep breath, expelling the cold air. He hoped the next corner was where he was to turn west. He felt he could be swallowed up by the size and sounds of the urban city. Looking east on Washington Street, the city's first skyscraper stood 17 stories high, housing Merchants Bank. It wrapped a corner of South Meridian Street. Dominating an entire block farther east was the Marion County Courthouse, a massive three-story structure of the Renaissance style. It featured a tower with a clock and a mansard roof. Almost directly behind it stood Tomlinson Hall, a site for lectures and social and political events. Its ground floor was a vegetable and fruit market run by immigrants, as well as the city market adjoining it, already an East Side fixture. Retail stores were in full swing along Washington Street, with L.S. Ayers already taking its place as a grand dame. It had lots of company with the H.P. Wasson and L. Strauss stores, while a block north stood the William H. Block Company. The stores served as downtown anchors. A gigantic emporium and a Pembroke arcade, European in style, featured small shops. Newspapers flourished, and the Griffin Block downtown housed the offices of the afternoon paper, the Indianapolis News. The morning newspaper, the Indianapolis Star, was published a few blocks east of downtown. Across this street, the Kresge Building was home to the offices of the Ku Klux Klan. Charles W. Jewett was the city's mayor, but Klan leader D.C. Stevenson wielded his own kind of power. He lived in a lavish home in the Irvington neighborhood. Within a mile square, there were a dozen movie houses. The Keiths, Lowe's, and Lyric were opulent and could seat more than 1,000 customers for their films and stage shows, while smaller venues brought in vaudeville, circus acts, and B-westerns. The Orpheum featured a large organ. The weary traveler's eyes were in awe of the building ahead that loomed larger as he walked closer. He did not know it was the city's landmark hotel, the Claypool, originally built as the Bates House. It featured balconies and became famous as President-elect Abraham Lincoln chose it to deliver one of his speeches. The young traveler was also not aware the structure behind him, tall and elegant, was the newly completed Lincoln Hotel. It was one of the city's few flat-iron buildings. Indianapolis was more urban than rural, with a population of more than 300,000. Its bulging population had spilled out into pocket neighborhoods, ringing the mile square while others were pushing the boundaries. On the Near East Side, Lockerbie Square featured elegant homes and cobblestone streets. An Italian-style red brick home was occupied by the poet James Whitcomb Riley. Woodruff Place was the city's first suburb, and one of its grand mansions was the setting for Booth Tarkington's novel, The Magnificent Ambersons. The neighborhood featured esplanades with ornate fountains, urns, and statuary. Up North Meridian Street, architecturally beautiful mansions were already being built, and the Perry Estate occupied a large plot of land on the White River that snaked through the city. Country clubs were a great part of social life. Schools, both public and parochial, anchored neighborhoods, and a public library existed. Radio was beginning to play a big part in the lives of Hoosiers. The late 1800s and early 1900s, the city enjoyed a golden age where art and literature flourished. Authors reached national attention with their writings. Tarkington was perhaps the best known, winning a Pulitzer Prize. Alongside him, artist studios abounded, and even the upper floor of the state capitol was said to have been learning schools for T.C. Steele, William Forsythe, and J. Otis Adams. The community's west side was dotted with immigrant settlements from the Balkan countries. They bordered the area around Indiana Avenue, which housed the black population. Along the avenue, jazz and blues bands were spawning such great musicians as the Montgomery Brothers, Dizzy Gillespie, and the Hampton Group. Madam C.J. Walker had made her mark there as a business tycoon. Farther west, off the banks of the White River, German and Irish immigrants lived in modest homes in Stringtown, while Serbs, Slovenes, and Hungarians settled in Hauville. The giant meatpacking company, Kingens, employed many immigrants. Indianapolis was already making its mark as an automotive center by running 500-mile races on the brick oval of the Speedway track. The Stutz Motor Company produced automobiles. Less than 100 Greeks had immigrated to the city, and they found work as peddlers and laborers. A handful began small businesses. They lived over storefronts along West Washington Street and around the sprawling military park. Although small in number, they established a Greek Orthodox church on West Street, bordering the park. The young traveler pulled the collar of his coat higher around his neck, and his eyes squinted against the falling snow that was falling faster and swirling in circles against the strong wind. Crossing the street was an obstacle course, as he was in the middle of the city's commercial hub, Washington and Illinois Streets. The streetcars were noisy, automobile horns were honking, and pedestrians scuffled around him. Women were dressed in warm long coats and skirts, and men held on tightly to their hats. He entered a cigar store on the ground level of the Claypool Hotel, and again pulled out the scrap of paper reading State House from his pocket. The clerk braved the cold and stepped outside to direct him west on Washington to the next intersection. Within minutes, the dome of the Capitol was visible through the gray, wintry sky. The immigrant's eyes moistened, and he smiled with joy, not because of the State House, but because he had spotted a peddler. The old man was standing next to his cart, filled with hot chestnuts, on the southwest corner of the building. The traveler broke into a gallop and tried to speak, but words would not come. Within seconds, he dashed across the street and embraced the stunned peddler. He had found his father. Father and son quickly pushed the cart down South Illinois Street through a protected alley. The peddler led his son up the steps of the dim and dreary boarding house. Their room was shared by seven other immigrant men. The Greek traveler spent his first night in Indianapolis, the city where he would live the rest of his life. He had found a new home, in a new city, in a new country, joining the thousands of Greek immigrants who followed their dreams to a new world. The traveler's name was Paul Janoukas. He was not just another young immigrant who had placed his name on the registry books of Ellis Island. He was my father. That's the end of the article, and a little bit more about the author, Georgia Janoukas Buchanan, the daughter of Greek immigrants to Indianapolis, earned her degree from Butler University and went on to become a journalist in Indianapolis and Washington, D.C. Following her journalism career, she devoted years to managing gala fundraisers for nonprofits. She has been involved in Special Olympics and other organizations devoted to special needs persons. This article is based upon her memoir, 428 and a Half, My Journey Beyond the Railroad Tracks, 2012. Now we're reading from the Wabash and Erie Canal Notebook, Allen and Huntington Counties, by Thomas E. Castaldi. Copyright 1995 by Thomas E. Castaldi. And we're starting the chapter, Wabash and Erie Canal in Huntington County, Indiana. For the people of the old Northwest Territory, the Native American Indians, French, British, and Americans, rivers were the highways through the dense forests. For explorers and travelers in northeast Indiana, the Maumee and Wabash rivers were very important waterways, but the two rivers were separated by a low ridge southwest of present-day Fort Wayne, Indiana. This ridge, the Continental Divide, was the only land barrier on the shortest and one of the most important water routes between Quebec and New Orleans. Native Indians knew the value of the land bridge between the two waterways. The great Miami chief, Little Turtle, called it the Glorious Gate. Incoming settlers named it the Long Portage, and it quickly became important to them to control this route. All parties knew that whoever controlled the portage commanded the Glorious Gate to the Western Territories. Pressure for access to the upper Wabash Valley increased after the War of 1812. First, because the U.S. government had no land on the eastern seaboard to offer discharged soldiers or farmers who wanted additional holdings. And second, because the military importance of the Maumee-Wabash portage was now well known. It was evident that the rich soil of the Wabash Valley could produce agricultural products, but there was no way to ship the products to eastern markets. Those seeking to develop this area of Indiana began to demand that the American government open up the Wabash River Valley for settlement and provide it with means of transportation. As Europeans and Americans made intrusions into Miami territory, the Indians' traditional lifestyle and self-supporting system began to deteriorate. Furthermore, the declining numbers of fur-bearing animals, which had provided the Indians with their principal item of trade, forced the Indians to rely increasingly on annuities from the government for the necessities of life. Many Americans were very willing to exploit these circumstances. Promises of generosity for their land excited many Indians, although thoughtful people, such as Little Turtle, warned against selling Indian land. Piece by piece, the U.S. government dismantled the Miami lands. The process began with the 1795 Treaty of Greenville and ended with the removal of the Miami in 1846. During this time, land from Fort Wayne to Huntington and throughout the Wabash River Valley passed to the Americans. On March 2, 1827, land for a canal was granted by Congress. The Treaty of Paradise Spring, signed October 23, 1826, had included a provision for a canal route through the remaining Miami lands. The waterway was to be 30 feet wide and 6 feet deep, and would be called the Wabash and Erie Canal. In 1828, the Army Corps of Engineers proposed a route from Toledo to Fort Wayne to the landing place, the forks of the Wabash where the Little Wabash River joins the Wabash, and on to the mouth of the Tippecanoe River near Lafayette. Below this point, the Wabash River was considered navigable by steamboat. The federal land grant for the canal extended into Ohio in order to connect it with the Miami and Erie Canal. Ohio had a network of canals, and many Ohioans thought the Wabash and Erie Canal would divert commerce away from the Ohio waterway system. Because the Ohio Canal system's economic well-being was threatened, many delays were encountered before the channel reached the Indiana-Ohio line. Financing for the canal was made part of the Mammoth Board of Internal Improvements Act of 1835. From the beginning, this Indiana legislative action had long-term potential for corruption of officials and for legislative folly. An impatient public placed pressure on state government officials to put too many transportation improvements in place too quickly. When land sales for the canal did not produce the necessary construction funds, bonds were issued which, along with other credits, put the state into debt. Indiana went bankrupt in 1850 and did not clear itself of debt until 1903. Because of the bankruptcy, the state of Indiana established a new state constitution in 1851, which prohibited borrowing except for defense purposes or for casual and temporary debts for state operations. In February 1832, two important events took place. The legislature of Indiana, in anticipation of a tide of immigration to the region through which the canal was to be constructed, established several new counties. On February 2nd, Governor Noah Noble approved an act entitled An Act Establishing the Counties of Huntington, Wabash, and Miami. 3 weeks later, on February 22nd, the contract for the 25-mile Fort Wayne-Huntington section was let. On that day, a Huntington man, Elias Murray, dug the first spadeful of dirt for the canal. Washington's birthday was chosen because Washington was seen as the foremost promoter of American canals. One of the great engineering feats of modern times, the canal was constructed using axe, saw, pick, spade, auger, chisel, hammer, hand forge, hand drill, gunpowder, wheelbarrows, carts, and wagons. Power employed was manpower and that of horse and ox. When finally completed in 1854, the Wabash and Erie Canal reached from Toledo, Ohio, to Evansville, Indiana. The canal was a 468-mile stretch of navigable water that some have called the longest artificial waterway in the world, when it was in fact the second longest. As a matter of fact, it was the longest in America since only China's Grand Canal was longer. Laborers, who were called navvies and who were mainly Irish immigrants, were hired to dig the canal through the swamp and wilderness. contracts for the construction of the canal were given to various parties. The contractors sometimes had great difficulty in getting laborers and did not care to assume too much responsibility. Working conditions were difficult. The men were plagued by dysentery, cholera, and malaria. Disease and accidents caused so many deaths that in some sections of the canal, stories circulated about one worker dying for every 6 feet of its construction. To help the workers keep their minds off their hardships, a man called a jigger boss moved among the crowd of laborers. His job was to supply jiggers of whiskey to the thirsty navvies. Along with their construction skills, the Irish workers brought a love for the free-for-all scrimmage and for feuding. One such skirmish was particularly memorable. Quote, "A few miles west of the town of Huntington was a division line between parts of the work done by two contractors. Each contractor had several hundred Irishmen employed. The wages paid each man per day was $1 cash and a certain number of jiggers of whiskey. Nearly all the whiskey was then home-brewed and not subject to internal revenue tax, therefore selling for 12.5 cents per gallon. The contractors bought the whiskey by the barrel and could easily afford to pay salaries, partly with whiskey. Those working east from the point of division called themselves Corkonians, having come from the historic city of Cork, and the other gang called themselves the Downians, or Fardowns, having come from the district farther down in the Emerald Island. The Corkonians were receiving 6 jiggers a day besides the cash, and the Downians were only permitted to sip their glass 4 times a day. A number of Downians left their brethren and were employed on the east part of the channel. To this action, the other Downians objected and demanded their return, saying that the Corkonians were not fit company for their aristocratic blood. The Corkonians resented this and sent back a challenge. Work on the canal stopped, and preparations for battle were begun. A number of Indians were begged to join, but the interference of the chief kept the red men neutral. The fever was at blood heat when the Corkonians began their march, intending to meet their foe somewhere in the vicinity of Largo. On the march, they confiscated every implement of war that could be found and carried impediments of whiskey. When their march through the town of Huntington began, women and children hid. A cave along the little river seemed a retreat for nearly all the women and children in the town. The cave was located near where the Huntington Light and Fuel Company's electric light plant stands. While the women and children were imprisoned in their retreat, the march of the Irish continued westward. Passing through, they confiscated the cannon brought here by Dr. George Fate and added it to their fighting equipment. When the armies met, the scene following was not nearly so bad as was predicted. Neither side had anything with which to fight except their picks and shovels and the single cannon. Much to the chagrin of the generals, no ammunition for the cannon had been brought, but gravel from the banks of the canal was substituted for canister, and a few volleys were fired, not at the enemy but toward the sky, just to let them know of the presence of the cannon. There were a few skirmishes with fists at the outposts, but the sentinels reported all's well, and the foreman of the gangs arbitrated the matter satisfactorily. The Irish returned to their work, the majority of the workmen continued their work in peace, drinking their jiggers in equal quantities, wishing luck to all." End quote. Some Irish canal workers settled in this area, establishing an Irish community in built St. Mary's Catholic Church in Huntington. The Germans founded the other Huntington Catholic Church, Saints Peter and Paul. The Irish and the Germans provided the most distinctive ethnic elements in the Huntington community. Work on the canal was completed 3 years after construction began. On July 3, 1835, the flow of water in the canal channel from Fort Wayne reached Huntington, and that evening the first canal boat, Indiana, docked at Burke's Lock in Huntington. The next day, on July 4th, the canal was officially opened from Fort Wayne to Huntington, the first section of the canal opened in Indiana. A big celebration in Fort Wayne was followed by another in Huntington. F.S. Bash described the excitement, quote, Late in the afternoon, the packet boat Indiana, Captain Asa Fairfield Master, arrived at Huntington and tied up at the upper lock, then known as Burke's Lock. On board was a large and enthusiastic party of Fort Wayne citizens, who were met by an equally enthusiastic throng of Huntington people. In anticipation of the arrival of the first canal boat, Dr. George A. Fate had brought a small cannon from Dayton, Ohio, and the little gun now boomed out its noisy welcome. The next day, the Indiana returned to Fort Wayne, taking the cannon along, end quote. The canal was not an easy enterprise to manage. Quote, the canal required round-the-clock attention. To stop a small leak before it became a torrent that crumbled a bank and emptied the channel, to restore banks and bridges washed out by Wabash River floods, to repair locks and aqueducts, to oversee lock tenders and to collectors. Grass in the channel had to be mowed several times a summer. The cut stuff prevented lock gates from fitting tightly and caused a loss of water of which, in a dry stream, there was barely enough to float a boat, if that. One packet took 3 days going from Logansport to Fort Wayne, scraping bottom all the way, and getting there only by the aid of another boat to swell her through on the wash from the Blunt Bow. Engineers and superintendents faced a never-ending conflict with nature, not to speak of a running fight with human perfidy. Miscreants maliciously cut canal banks and drained reservoirs, sometimes petulantly tore out a dam. Unscrupulous skippers cooked cargo manifests to swindle toll collectors. The struggle of management against man and the elements was so costly that the W&E never made a profit for the state, which eventually threw in the sponge millions of dollars in the red, unquote. A typical canal boat was about 90 feet long and 13 feet wide. Energy to power the canal boat through the still water channel came from the 2, sometimes 3, mules or horses, which were harnessed to a long tow line attached to the boat. Prodded by a driver, the animals tugged on the tow line from the tow path that was constructed alongside the canal. The mules or horses were stabled on board the boat and could pull a cargo of 1,000 tons or more. Some canal boats were privately owned by individuals, while others were operated by large companies. The passenger boats, called packets, ran on a regular schedule and charged a published rate of fare. Sleek packets were made to go through the water, sometimes at speeds as high as 6 or 7 miles per hour. The 25-mile trip from Fort Wayne to Huntington should have taken about 5 hours at a rate of 5 miles per hour. However, the canal boat had to be stair-stepped uphill and down by means of locks, and passing through locks added to the time. Locking time for a boat was generally about 1 minute per foot of depth of water in the lock. Stops were sometimes made at important locks and ports, such as those in Roanoke and Mahon, which added more time to the 25-mile journey. The fare to travel on the packets was 3 cents per mile. To travel on the freighters cost 2.5 cents per mile. Meals and lodging were included in the price. Well, that's all the time we have for today. We'll continue this book next time. This has been Pat with Hoosier History. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.